This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to take a look back on the year in pop culture with three of our critics. Later, rock critic Ken Tucker will be here with his 10 best list, and critic at large John Powers will talk about the big media stories of the year. First, the best movies of the year with our film critic David Edelstein, who is also film critic for New York Magazine. Hi, David. Well, we've asked you to bring your 10 best list with you, so I'll start by asking you to run through it for us.
Okay, well, as usual, you know, I'm not going to limit myself to 10. I think in honor of the Coen brothers, A Serious Man, and the Bar Mitzvah, I'm going to go with the lucky 13. So here they are. Summer Hours, the Olivier Assayas film, is my number one film of the year, followed by Brothers, directed by Jim Sheridan. Everlasting Moments, Jan Troell's entrancingly beautiful Swedish film. Then a tie. The Fantastic Mr. Fox, and Coraline, because why choose among such stop-motion riches? Then we're following that with A Serious Man, Joel and Ethan Coen's Jewish joke with a sting, James Toback's documentary Tyson, and another doc, Food Inc., followed by another doc, actually really a tone poem by Terrence Davies called Of Time in the City. Then the great political satire In the Loop, followed by Spike Jonze's magical Where the Wild Things Are, Catherine Bigelow's great adrenaline war movie The Hurt Locker, and finally, Avatar.
All right. Thank you. We're so lenient in allowing you more than 10. Now, I bet a lot of our listeners have not seen your number one movie, Summer Hours, so just tell us briefly why you chose it.
Well, Summer Hours is a film that I think encapsulates a lot of things that have happened over the last decade. It uses the device of the selling off of a dead woman's estate and a lot of precious artworks. And it captures, as no other film I've seen, the passing of the old world with its indigenous forms of culture, the rise of globalization, the weakening of traditional family ties. I mean, it's very French. It has you know, a predictable whiff of xenophobia. But at the same time, I think it really does capture this sense of loss that we all have as we come together as a global community.
Did you have any favorite performances this year?
Oh, I had many. I think there is nothing to compare this year with Colin Firth in A Single Man. I found the movie a little over-designed, no surprise from Tom Ford, who is a great fashion designer. But Colin Firth is shockingly vivid as a gay man who, in 1962, can't begin to reconcile his private self with his public self, and who suffers in ways that I think are unbearably moving. Meryl Streep, of course, as Julia Child. One of the most soulful impersonations in the history of movies. God, she's funny. Jeff Bridges is amazing in a rather small film as an alcoholic country western singer in Crazy Heart. What I found stunning about this performance is how he totters around backstage blind drunk, but then when he gets in front of the mic, he kind of leans back from his guitar and uses the weight of it to center him and keep him upright in front of the microphone, which is the perfect metaphor for what music means to his life. I should also mention Christian McKay as Orson Welles in the film Me and Orson Welles, if for no other reason that it seems as if Welles has been reincarnated in front of your eyes. It's absolutely stunning. You can go back and look at Citizen Kane and go, that's the guy.
If you don't mind, I'd like to just interject one of my favorite performances of the year.
Please. Please.
I don't even remember the actor's name. He's a German actor, and I probably wouldn't pronounce it right even if I could remember it, but he's the star of Quentin Tarantino's film.
Christoph Waltz.
Yes.
A wonderful,
yes.
Insinuating, sadistic. I mean, he takes all of the sadism Tarantino puts into that role of this Jew hunter and adds this sort of kick of humor and this sort of mordant irony to it. And, I mean, you'd never dream the man is married to a Jewish woman in real life. It's an absolutely stunning performance. And I think it gives a film that I liked very much, but is a kind of pastiche a very, at times, cartoony pastiche, it gives it an edge of psychological realism that I think is one of the things that puts it over. He might well win an Academy Award for that performance.
Yeah, well, he was great. And the film is Inglourious Basterds. And we're going to be rerunning our interview with Quentin Tarantino in the week between Christmas and New Year's. Well, David, in addition to this being the end of the year, it's the end of the decade. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about how movies have changed during this decade, which I still don't know what to call, the zeros, the noughts.
The aughts. The naughty aughts, yes.
Okay.
Well, it's funny. I was thinking of what was my favorite movie of the decade? It was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, written by Charlie Kaufman and directed by Michel Gondry. And I was trying to think what that film thematically says about the naughty aughts. And I think that the idea of the tension between reality and fantasy has gotten more pronounced in the last decade, and the ways in which the movie is sort of like a Philip K. Dick paranoid fever dream wedded to a screwball romance. And there's no way it could have happened. The technology wouldn't have allowed it, and the sensibility wouldn't have allowed it in any other decade. And it also made me think that at the end of the last decade came The Matrix. And The Matrix sort of played on the sense that we all have that maybe reality isn't real, that maybe we're living in a vast simulacrum. And so much of the movies of the 90s, say, were about managing to break through into real life, break through from this illusory life into what is real and tactile. And now we come to the end of this decade, and there's this wonderful movie out called Avatar, in which it's only by going into this make-believe world a man can truly fulfill his potential, can rewrite history. It's sort of a Native American parable, and in which we actually go back and save the Native Americans from the imperialist capitalist forces that would wipe them out. And I just thought it was really striking that we've come about face, and now we sort of hunger for our virtual selves, our avatars, to take on, you know, the final frontier, which is maybe in our own minds.
When you look back on the decade, do you think there's a big change in what's considered bankable? I mean, we started the decade in a state of more prosperity than we're in now. Like, what has happened to the movie studios with the financial crisis?
Well, it's horribly depressing. The most depressing thing is that this is a boffo year for Hollywood. They have actually made a ton of money, but they've made all their money with what they call event films, which are giant movies like Avatar, 3D, IMAX, movies, The Dark Knight, movies that everybody has to see and they line up for. They go at midnight the day before opening and they get their tickets online way in advance, the Twilight movies. Meanwhile, specialty divisions are closing left and right, the ones that distribute indie films and foreign films. People aren't spending as much money to go to those kind of movies. They're not breaking through. Most people are seeing them on DVD. At the same time, two of the movies on my list this year, Summer Hours and Everlasting Moments, one of the reasons I reviewed them on Fresh Air was that they were available to rent for a price the same day they opened in New York and Los Angeles all over the country. Now, of course, I'd rather people see them on a big screen, but I'm realistic to know that all but a handful of indie or foreign films these days make it beyond the bigger cities. So I guess that's the silver lining, that you can see these films for the first time. And I suppose it's great that the prices of these gigantic, ginormous, big, wide HD screens is coming down and that everybody can see them, but something is lost.
So you mentioned that big event movies are where Hollywood is making the profits, and a lot of the smaller movies in most cities, you only get to see them on DVD. How do you think this is going to play out in the next decade in terms of what films even get made?
Well, don't forget, I mean, the cost of making a movie has gone down. I mean, I can pick up a movie camera and make a feature by tomorrow. God knows nobody would want to watch it. But and you see a film like Paranormal Activity, which thanks to a very shrewd marketing campaign and the fact that it was actually really scary, used a single point of view, essentially somebody's home video camera that the character sets up in order to monitor supernatural activity. So that's a movie that cost, I forget the exact number, but it was in the tens of thousands. And yet it made 70, 80, 90 million. It became technically the most profitable film ever made. So we can all go out and make movies on high definition video. The question is anyone going to pick them up for distribution? Is anyone going to put them in theaters? Well, a lot of them maybe not, but everybody can have their own website and everybody can offer them for download. And I have a feeling that a lot of smaller movies increasingly will be niche marketed to people who find them horror movies or documentaries and will be able to go online and we'll be able to download them, some of them for free, some of them for a price.
We're going through such a kind of difficult for many people transition period now because popular culture as we know it in books, movies, music has been so transformed by digital technology and so many of the things we love seem to be dying or struggling. And, you know, you can trust that new things will take their place and are taking their place. But in the meantime, it's kind of difficult.
We don't know how this is all going to shake out in terms of how we absorb culture. I know my wife is a book editor, and everybody's worried about the fact that many books are going to be downloaded into little tablets. On one hand, you're spared the cost of actually printing them. On the other hand, the margin of profit is going to go way, way down. It's just going to change the culture in a way that we don't know what the rippling effects of this are going to be. Now, there's no question that in the last decade, maybe too many movies were put in theaters and not all of them very good. But I would hate to see us limited to the internet in order to access the most interesting things, even if they do go viral, as some of them will. Inevitably, there will be a lot of them that will be lost.
David, is there any film you'd like to recommend for the holidays?
Well, other than Avatar, which I suggest everybody line up for, and Brothers, which I've already reviewed, I am drawing an absolute and total blank on that because I can't really recommend The Lovely Bones. I like what Invictus is doing, what the Clint Eastwood Mandela biopic Invictus is doing. I love that it makes a sterling example of Mandela's nonviolent approach to reconciling his benighted country when it could theoretically have broken out into a civil war. There's really nothing coming out this Christmas that has captured my imagination, certainly not Nine, the musical, the star-studded musical that everybody's waiting for. I, along with you, I think, loved Rob Marshall's Chicago.
Yes.
But here, that kind of his choppy editing doesn't fit the music at all. It's just a hash, and there's a lot of butt wiggling and a lot of sort of women posing sultrily in lingerie, but there's very little in the way of dance, which is one of the things I like in a musical. And even though the singing is very good, the downside of that is that you actually hear the lyrics, which is in this case not so good.
Well, David, thank you so much for sharing your 10 best lists with us, or your 13 best list, and some of your thoughts about the year and the decade. Always good to talk with you, and I wish you happy holidays and a very good new year.
Well, thank you, Terry, and happy holidays, and have a good time at the movies to all our listeners.
David Edelstein is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for New York Magazine. And I want to remind our listeners that David's 10 best list, 13 best list, will be on our website at freshair.npr.org. We're looking back on the year in pop culture. Here to talk about the big media stories of the year is our critic at large, John Powers, who is also film critic for Vogue and writes the blog Absolute Powers at Vogue.com. He used to write a column about the intersection of politics and culture for LA Weekly. Hi, John. Now, we asked you to talk about a couple of the biggest media stories of the year that you wanted to comment on. So let's start with the fact that last year the big media story was the election, and this year it was President Obama. And last year he was a media phenomenon. This year he was discussed in a different way on the media. So as we end 2009, I'd like you to talk about the impact of President Obama on the media landscape.
Well, I think the most striking thing is that a man who was elected with everyone, whether they liked him or not, thinking he's kind of a cool and calming influence, proved over the course of 2009 not to have a presidency that turned out to be cool and calming at all. And this is really clear in the media, where we find that things are now as ratcheted up, I think, as they were during an election year, which I think is in a way startling and perhaps unprecedented. I mean, one of the strange features of the run-up to last year's election was that President Bush had had what was most people considered one of the longest lame duck presidencies in American history. And as part of that, that allowed the media coverage to flow into what seemed like the longest election campaign in all of human history. And I thought that people would be tired of that. Yet what oddly happened out of this was that the media got into a kind of permanent campaign mode, so that now we're living in a world where everything seems to be as ratcheted as high as it was during an election campaign, even though really President Obama has been in office 11 months. He has 37 months to go before he's up for re-election. Yet we somehow live in this media world where everything he does is subjected to immediate response, immediate polls, and things like that.
Don't you think that's in a way a sign of the fact that the culture wars did not subside with the election of President Obama?
Yes, they didn't subside at all. What's interesting in media terms is the way that everything flipped, so that for 8 years, a network like Fox News, which was a conservative network, was clearly on the side of the administration, whereas people at MSNBC, for instance, the most famously liberal of the cable networks, were very anti the current administration. All of a sudden, you switch where a Democrat is president, and suddenly the liberals are playing defense, in a sense. And Fox has, I think, gotten a kind of new lease on life, because they actually get to do the thing that I think most journalists prefer to do, which is to go on the attack. That's where the fun is. It's not fun as a journalist, and I can tell you this as a person who is a journalist and who knows them. It's not fun to be the person saying, okay, maybe the health care plan isn't exactly what all of you hoped for, but it's still a good plan. It's much more fun to say it's going to take down the economy, the money doesn't work out, in fact, there might be death panels. That's the fun side. The unfun side is defending the current administration.
Though I have to say, on MSNBC, people like Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann don't necessarily defend the administration. They're often very critical.
They are. Well, I think that's one of the interesting cultural stylistic differences between conservatives and liberals, and in particular Republicans and Democrats. You know, you see that in the actual Congress, where there is a solid vote in the House, for instance, where no one will vote for various proposals of Obama, whereas Obama will lose 40 or 50 blue dog Democrats on lots of votes in the House. And that's the cultural style. Liberals take pride in being so honest that they will, if necessary, they will rip apart their own standard bearers in the interest of that honesty. And conservatives take pride in being disciplined and actually falling in line. And so you actually have the case where on certain nights, Rachel Maddow or Keith Olbermann are as critical, if not more critical, of Obama than you'll find on Fox.
This was the year that Glenn Beck emerged as a star of the right. What do you think explains his success?
Well, I think there are two things about Glenn Beck. The first is that he embodies a particularly strident form of conservatism that was almost a natural consequence of the election of a Democrat who's thought to be liberal, an African-American, and this after 8 years of a Republican administration. So there's that first side of just the ideological side. The second side is that he is, in his way, an astonishing performer. The person he reminds me most of, and this dates me a little bit, although I didn't watch the show much because I was growing up, is Jack Parr, who was this hugely volatile late-night talk show host. He did The Tonight Show, who would weep on the air and say outrageous things, then come back the next night and have to apologize and make outlandish claims and champion his favorites. And what Glenn Beck does is he weds the ideological side of himself with the entertainment volatility side of himself. Because nobody becomes a big success, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or Keith Olbermann, if it's pure ideology. to succeed in the current climate doing ideological radio, you have to be a good entertainer. And Glenn Beck is this person who, even if you don't like him, it's sometimes hard not to watch him because you don't know what he'll do.
I think Jack Parr is going to come back from his grave and demand equal time defend himself against the comparison with Glenn Beck.
The thing is, I don't think Jack Parr is like Glenn Beck, but in this particular respect, personality-wise, what they have in common is there's an immediacy and volatility to what they do. That's really what I think. I can't think of anyone in the media landscape in the years since Jack Parr who was that way. When I was a kid, I remember how my parents, who were great Jack Parr worshippers, always hated Johnny Carson because they thought he was the slick, packaged version of something. Clearly, I mean, Parr was a liberal, not a conservative. You know, Parr brought on Castro onto his show. I don't think Glenn Beck will bring Castro onto his.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're looking back at 2009 in popular culture with three of our critics. Let's get back to our interview with our critic at large, John Powers. He's also a film critic for Vogue, and he used to write a column on the intersection of culture and politics for LA Weekly. John's talking about the year in media. Now, one of the media stories that got the most coverage this year, which I know you want to talk about as one of your big media stories of the year, was Michael Jackson's death. And I wonder, what do you think it says that there was so much continuous coverage on the news channels and daily coverage in a lot of newspapers about his death and the subsequent funeral and family stories and so on?
Well, I think with whenever a story is this big, there's at least one side to it. And in this case, I think there are two huge sides to it. The first is one about the media in general, which is that we're living through a moment when almost all the traditional media feel that they're living in a fragmenting landscape where everything is crumbling around them, and they're terrified that they're losing their audience. So they spend all their time looking for the one big story that everybody can talk about and will understand. And Michael Jackson offered this because he was, for a time, probably the most famous person in the world. So if you're a media person and someone like Michael Jackson dies, that you then realize, oh, this is somebody who everybody knows. And in fact, we will do this constantly because, in fact, this is the thing that might seem to bind together an audience. And so everyone rushes to that one big story. You know, in shorter-term versions, they did the same thing with Balloon Boy. In political terms, that's happening with Sarah Palin right now. You know, if I can just take this sidestep with Sarah Palin, it's interesting that she's the first person to run for vice president who lost, who a year after is still bigger headlines sometimes than the president. And this is because everybody knows she's a hot button figure. Everyone knows who she is. And she can be part of the one big story of the day when she says something. The second side of the Michael Jackson thing is that he was an amazing figure. You know, it's not pure trashiness in our culture that made people interested in Michael Jackson. A lot of people in America knew him as a cute little kid who could sing. He then went on to make some of the most popular and influential pop music of all time, had a weird personal life that brought into things like his sense of his own racial identity, the weird family dynamics he had, all the stuff with not wanting to grow up. You know, he had Neverland Ranch. So the idea of the eternal boy thing, you know, he contained that too. So you put all of that there, and then you add in the fact that probably he might have been maybe the most influential crossover artist and breakthrough racial figure in American life. When I look at the great crossover figures and the ones that seem to, quote, transcend race, although that's a silly term, you realize that Oprah is one of them, Michael Jordan was one of them, and, you know, Obama was perceived to be one of them. You know, but clearly the person who got there first was Michael Jackson. At the time he died, I kept telling people that I think it's quite possible you wouldn't have an Obama presidency if Michael Jackson hadn't been the most influential entertainer in the 80s and early 90s.
We've been talking about the media. Any thoughts about how the internet has changed in 2009 as we end this decade?
Well, I think that what's peculiar about how the internet has changed is that what I thought was the fastest and most immediacy obsessed thing in the world has grown faster and more immediacy obsessed in the course of this year. I mean, I think the whole and to me rather tiresome Twitter phenomenon means that what has happened is that we've gone from thinking that we could get something every hour or every half hour to the realization that people can send you out things that will reach you every single second of the day, and that people have begun filing their thoughts from the least likely of places. I mean, to me, I find it astonishing that professional basketball players, for instance, sitting on the bench will actually be sending out more or less personal newscasts from the bench in the course of a game. So I think that the most striking feature of it is that. And then probably the parallel one, which is slightly different, which is a deeper phenomenon, is the incredible explosion of social networking. So that I think probably more people over the age of 30 joined Facebook than the people behind Facebook would ever have imagined possible if they lived forever. That the idea that all of a sudden that you can be sending out your tendrils everywhere is a radically transformative idea. I mean, I know that I have heard from ex-girlfriends, high school people I hadn't talked to, people who hear me on the show and hate me. I mean, the whole thing and in a way they never could before because of the social networking thing. And I'm not a big-time social networker. We've reached the point, interestingly enough, where traditional old media people will go into editorial meetings at the most famous papers and magazines in the country, and their editors will say, make sure you tweet your articles. And you'll think, really? Like the New York Times people have to tweet their articles? They write for the New York Times. And yet this is the way that it's gone. They will tell the people at, you know, Time magazine, make sure you put your article on Facebook. And once again, you think, but this is Time magazine. They don't have to put their article on Facebook. And yet that's what's happening.
So what do you do with your articles?
I put my articles on Facebook. I have yet to enter the Twitter sphere, but I have found that I get much more response from what I do if I put it on social networking sites, that people do see them there. And in fact, it does push readership up. And if nothing else, my friends can always see what I'm saying in a way they hadn't seen before. And, you know, then they can, you know, write sniping little notes about the mistakes I made, which is what friends are for, you know. And so I do it, but I find it strange to be in the realm of self-promotion. You know, I think most writers have huge enough egos and all sorts of weird vanities, but I think one of the ways that it's changed is I think that none of us thought that in addition to writing a piece, maybe your job is to be out there selling the piece in the public. But in a landscape where no one feels that anything will necessarily get noticed, then it's very complicated.
Now, when you say you get more of a response now that you're on Facebook, do you mean that more people respond because it's a responsive type of media? Or do you think that the audience is actually bigger on Facebook, the readership is bigger on Facebook than in the actual magazine? And is there any way of really telling for sure?
Yes. Well, I think I think in the case of Vogue, the actual magazine still gets a much bigger readership than what I would do online. Partly because I work for a magazine that's only recently begun putting a lot of resources into going online. But what I've found is that, you know, for example, let's take a piece I write about film. I have been friended by almost everyone from studios and publicists and everyone involved in film. You know, in one way or another, they are on my friends list. If I post something, the people who are immediately interested in it read it, and then they pass it on to other people because they will post it on their site. So what happens is that it ripples out in that particular way, one person at a time. But if you're talking to someone who's a publicist with a friends list of 4,000 people, and they post the fact that I've posted my thing, and they say it's good, suddenly you're more likely to have those 4,000 people reading it. It's a very different kind of thing. It's where it's almost like person by person that you're doing it, rather than just assuming that what you're doing is so important that, in fact, anybody will automatically pick it up.
And of course, just because somebody is putting it on Facebook or tweeting it doesn't mean that anyone's reading it necessarily. Go ahead.
Yes. No. I think that more than at any point in history, there's this weird difference between different kinds of media, where if you write for certain places, you feel as if you're putting a message in a bottle and throwing it out there, and you're not sure whether anybody is reading it. And at the same time, you have people with small little blogs with their dedicated group of 50 or 60 readers who are always replying. So they in fact have instant feedback and community. And those will be people who basically don't really have many readers. And then people who have lots and lots of readers will often get almost no comments because they're part of a big media organization and people don't really feel the same intimacy. And so therefore they don't reply to it. So that you could probably be writing for the New York Times and not hear much from anybody and have a tiny little blog and seem to be hearing from everybody. And yet if you write for the New York Times, you'll have a 1,000 times bigger readership, a 10,000 times bigger readership.
Well, John, thank you very much for talking about the media this year. And I want to wish you happy holidays and a happy new year.
Well, thank you very much, and happy holidays to all the listeners.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and film critic for Vogue. He writes the blog Absolute Powers on Vogue.com. We're looking back on the year in pop culture with Fresh Air's critics. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, who is also editor at large at Entertainment Weekly, has brought his 10 best list with him. Hi, Ken. Well, we asked you to choose two of your favorite tracks of the year from your 10 best list and to play those tracks for us. So why don't you introduce the first for us and tell us why you chose it?
The first track is by Taylor Swift, who's a 19-year-old country pop singer-songwriter. The song I really like of hers is called You Belong With Me. The album, which is called Fearless, it was her intention to write songs that were basically diary entries sent to music, which could have been very, very coy and insufferable, but she did it with such conviction and lack of irony that I thought it was wonderful. And I think that You Belong With Me is one of the best songs on the album.
Okay, let's hear it. This is Taylor Swift.
You're on the phone with your girlfriend. She's upset. She's going off about something that you said. 'Cause she doesn't get your humor like
Taylor Swift, and her album Fearless is on our rock critic Ken Tucker's 10 Best list. And I have to say, Ken, I remember when you reviewed this on the show, and I think that it was late in 2008, actually, when it first came out. And
yes.
I was thinking, this is kind of interesting, but I wonder why he chose it to review on the show. And were you expecting her to become the sensation that she did?
No, I mean, certainly this was her year in a sense of pop prominence all over the place. I mean, she did that crossover from country to pop music, accomplished that very swiftly, so to speak. And I think she did it because she presented something fresh. She's not jaded as so many mainstream pop acts are. And she got embroiled in a controversy midway through the year. In September, the MTV Video Awards, now notoriously, she was accepting an award for Best Video, and Kanye West took the stage and said that Beyoncé should have won this award. And it was, you know, the YouTube moment seen around the world. And there was poor little fragile Taylor Swift caught in the middle of it, yet benefiting from this enormous controversy.
And I want you to play the other track that you've brought with you, which is an interesting contrast to Taylor Swift.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of not funny, but indicative of the year that two of my favorite pieces of music, one is by someone who hasn't yet turned 20, and the other is by a 60-plus-year-old man. It's Loudon Wainwright III and his kind of project more than just a mere album. It's called High, Wide, and Handsome, the Charlie Poole Project. It's his salute to Charlie Poole, a banjo player who died in 1931, and it's a combination of original songs and covers of Charlie Poole's music. And the song I'd like to play is the title song, which Loudon wrote, called High, Wide, and Handsome.
High, wide, and handsome, that's how I like living. High, wide, and handsome, that's how life should be. Low, skinny, and ugly, that's for other people. High, wide, and handsome suits me to a T. Song, wine, and women, they're my three favorites. Beer, gin, and whiskey, that's five, six, and four. Saturday night, I like eating and dancing. Then I sleep all day Sunday, so I'm ready for more. High, wide, and handsome.
That's Loudon Wainwright, the title track of his album High, Wide, and Handsome, which is a salute to Charlie Poole. And can I share your enthusiasm for this double CD by Loudon Wainwright? And since Loudon Wainwright and Taylor Swift both have connections to country music, Charlie Poole was an all-time country musician, what do you think the state of country music is right now?
I think it's absolutely thriving. I think it's one of the most vital elements of country of pop music right now, because it can contain people as disparate as Taylor Swift and Loudon Wainwright, and then there are much more mainstream country performers such as Billy Currington and Miranda Lambert, both of whom are on my top 10 list, who are making country music that's very much in that kind of classic hardcore 1950s, 1960s, George Jones, Merle Haggard tradition. And so once you can have those kinds of songs all become hits, I think it speaks to the health of country music. I think the Loudon Wainwright, I listened to the interview that you did with him, Terry, and I thought it was really interesting the way So often we've thought of Loudon Wainwright over the decades as merely a satirist and someone who writes confessional songs. And for him to go outside himself and to immerse himself in another person's songs, in this case a pioneer country artist, I thought was really interesting and refocused attention on something that doesn't get much attention, which is Loudon Wainwright's voice. He's a very, very good singer. By contrast, Taylor Swift's voice is actually very fragile, and even I fell into a trap. I wrote a review for my magazine, Entertainment Weekly, in which I described her at an award ceremony as singing with a voice that was as wobbly as a newborn colt. And I realized afterwards that was ridiculous. I should not have said that, because Taylor Swift's fragile, wobbly voice is exactly the instrument that's needed for conveying these very emotionally fragile songs. It's the perfect conveyance for the emotions that she wants to express.
We've been talking about the year in pop culture with Fresh Air's critics. Let's get back to our rock critic, Ken Tucker, who's been talking about the year in music and has brought his 10 best list. I'm amazed at the role that TV has now in making hit records. And I think it's in part because radio itself is playing such a small role in making hit records. And young people in particular, I don't think they're growing up listening to music radio very much.
No, and people are consuming music in different ways. I mean, we've talked in recent years about how people really listen to their music not so much via the album format as by downloading singles at this point. And I think that in a lot of ways, it's not the radio, it's not listening with your ears, it's listening with your eyes and ears to videos on YouTube. That's certainly the way another phenomenon of this year, Susan Boyle, became such a huge success. She was on Britain's Got Talent, a show that wasn't even broadcast here, but she so wowed the judges with her performance that she became a star overnight, and her viewings on YouTube are in the hundreds of millions. So she's really somebody who benefited from this new kind of way of consuming music.
It's kind of interesting that the two big breakout singers who came out of TV competitions are so opposite. You know, Adam Lambert, who is so kind of big and theatrical and like, I know, I'm out of the closet now, and boy, am I transgressive. And then there's Susan Boyle, who looks like, you know, she was a shut-in for years and was suddenly on TV and then became a big star and seemed kind of traumatized by the whole deal for a while. And they have really different styles of performance, different kinds of material. They're just like opposites.
Totally. And it was fascinating to me. It was the first time I really got involved in American Idol. I intensely wanted Adam Lambert to win, because once I saw that what he was doing was completely confounding the judges every week by changing up his styles, his makeup, his costume, in addition to his voice, was as important to his performance every single week. And he just radiated this kind of confidence and this kind of sly humor that he wasn't intimidated by the judges. And I just thought Lambert was just a terrific figurehead, finally, for what could so often be a bland competition in American Idol. And so that kind of, you know, Lambert coming out of the closet, him performing in an award ceremony recently that was broadcast live, and his dancers simulated oral sex, and it caused a big ruckus, and there were threats of FCC, you know, investigations, all this kind of thing. It's just another case of, you know, someone hearkening back to rock and roll's old power to shock, and yet also working very, very much in a real mainstream pop tradition. I mean, you could book Adam Lambert tomorrow in Las Vegas for 6 months, and he would seem like the most natural performer there in the world.
Well, Ken, I think I should ask you to read your 10 best list for us.
Sure. Number one is Loudon Wainwright III, High, Wide, and Handsome, the Charlie Poole project. Number two is the Taylor Swift single, You Belong With Me. Number three is Fiery Furnaces, who seem to release one album a year, and I love every one of them. This one was called I'm Going Away. Number four is the album Revolution by Miranda Lambert, a country singer. Number five is Murdering Oscar and Other Love Songs, an album by Patterson Hood, who's the son of David Hood, who was bassist for the Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section. Number six is a single, a country single called People Are Crazy by Billy Currington, which David Letterman called the most perfect song of the year. It's a TV influence there. Number seven is Deer Tick, a band from Rhode Island, and their album Born on Flag Day. Number eight is a guy named Bob Dylan, who put out an album called Together Through Life, which I thought was wonderful. Number nine is a single called Say Hey, I Love You by Michael Franti and Spearhead. And number 10 is an album by a two-person group called LaRue from Britain, and their album was called LaRue.
And if you missed any of that list, it's, of course, on our website, npr.freshair.org. Ken, you've been a music critic as well as a TV critic for many years. You've been writing about music since the 70s. And as we look back on the end of the year and the end of a decade, can you just reflect a moment on how you think the role of the music critic has changed in the lives of listeners?
I think the role of the music critic has become largely as a consumer guide. I think Robert Christgau, who started a consumer guide, you know, 40 years ago now, was onto something with one paragraph reviews, because that's what an awful lot of magazines and websites want now, is get to the point, tell me if I should buy something or not. On the other hand, I think the internet has been my and other music critics' savior, in the sense that we can write as long and as detailed as we want about things. So I feel totally re-energized, both as a music and in my other life as a TV critic, writing for the internet, because I think it's where criticism is going to thrive in the future.
And do you feel like people read you on the internet?
Boy, do I feel like people read me on the internet. You get such instant response and such overwhelming positive response, that kind of, thank goodness somebody else likes Loudon Wainwright. Thank goodness you said that. You said that American Idol is bad. Or, you know, you're an incredible jerk. You don't know what you're talking about. That kind of thing. And then it's both very informed and very vulgar reactions to you, but at the same time, it's an audience. I can really feel so much more than I did a few years ago that I'm really writing for a very, very active, committed, vital audience.
Well, Ken, I want to wish you happy holidays, a happy new year. Thank you for being with us today and talking about the year in music and sharing your 10 best list.
Thanks so much, Terry. Same to you.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic and critic at large at Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a Merry Christmas. And if you don't celebrate Christmas, we wish you a happy holiday. We'll close today's show with my favorite Christmas song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And as I've done every Christmas for the past few years, I want to thank Hugh Martin for writing it. He's 95 now, and I know he sometimes listens to our show. I hope he's listening now so that I can wish him a Merry Christmas and a happy and healthy New Year. Hugh Martin wrote this song for Judy Garland to sing in the wonderful 1944 film Meet Me in St. Louis. I love the way she sings it. But I think I love even more the recording Hugh Martin made in 2005. Here he is singing and accompanying himself at the piano.
Here we are as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who were dear to us, gather near to us once more. Christmas now.